Good morning, everyone. I'm Jonathan, and this is my wife, Lynn, and we wanted to take a few minutes on the front end of our talks to talk a little bit about what it's like being a pastor and a pastor's spouse and some of the behind-the-scenes things that maybe we don't talk about in church or we don't hear about. So I'm going to start with Lynn sharing a bit. So go for it, babe.
Good morning, everyone. It's so good to be here, and I'm already starting to feel refreshed and more at peace and calm, and I'm so grateful for Fort for that. So I've been Jonathan's wife for almost 29 years and the wife of him as a pastor for over 24 years. And what I want to share today is some of my own experiences, but I know my experience is probably, it is different from what your pastor spouse may be going through in your own churches. So I kind of want to touch on that a little bit and perhaps give you some maybe new ways to think or some insight and some ways to support the pastor spouse too. So, because it is kind of this weird, unique role. And some pastor spouses had a bait and switch. So they got married not knowing their spouse was going to become a pastor. Thankfully, that was not my story. I knew when I was 18 that I was called to be a pastor's wife or a missionary. I knew that I would somehow be connected and tied to ministry. So when Jonathan and I were dating, he was heading somewhere else. Secret, the CIA. So he's so mysterious. And so I was praying, should I even be dating him? Because I knew my calling. He did not know my calling. I never shared that with him. And we broke up. Right before I graduated from Christian college, my mother told me years later how she bawled because I was graduating without a ring. You know, you paid all this money to send me to Christian college and I'm leaving with nothing. So, big failure on my part. So, in any event, Jonathan had another year, and I was in Maryland teaching, and we reconnected long distance. It's a really fun little story. And then when he got the call to be a pastor, we were married in 10 months. So it went by super fast. So, yes, he's amazing. Anyway, so I knew he was going to be a pastor. Sorry, he's very... Mystery, yes. So when I felt this call to be a pastor's wife, I was a little scared because my experience with other pastors' wives in different churches and different denominations was less than inspiring. They seemed to be kind of reclusive, keep to themselves. They actually seemed rather sad and boring. And I was like, I do not want to be that, you know. So when we were first married, Jonathan grew up as a pastor's kid. And so therefore, my mother-in-law was a pastor's wife. And so she was giving me all kinds of advice when we were first married and saying things to me like, don't trust anybody. Keep your thoughts and your feelings to yourself. Do not share your anything. Like, it's all confidential, like, you know, maybe I can tell you my name, but that's about it. So I was like, I can't do that, you know. So thankfully, somebody, and I don't even know who it was, gave me this book, and it was on being a pastor's wife, and I rolled my eyes big time when I saw this book. Like, I need more advice like that. But it was awesome because in the book, it talked about all the different ways to be a pastor's wife. Everything from like being a co-pastor with your spouse to like being the person who just looks after the pastor and then everything in between. And so when Jonathan came on staff, I was at one of the interviews, which made me a little nervous because I'm not getting paid, so why am I being interviewed? But I asked, what do you expect of me? And they gave the right answer, which was, we expect you to come to church. I can do that. Awesome. You know, I'm not going to be your piano player. I can play a little bit. I'm not great. I'm not going to sing for you. I don't even do a lot of this public speaking either. So I'm more like different seasons of life. I've done all different things. And I was talking with a pastor's wife this week. She's 8 years in, and she's like, Lynn, this is the loneliest I've ever been. And I'm surrounded by people. And I feel in every relationship, it's one way. I'm giving. And she's like, I don't need much, but I maybe need to have a relationship where I'm not giving. Not even that they give to me, but it's just kind of, it is. So I don't know what your spouse's wife is like at home, at your home church. But I do want to share that if you, I said this to Jonathan this morning, I am going to say it. If you don't know anything bad or mistakes that your pastor's wife did, I'd be a little worried. Truly. Because we're all sinners. And we need to be able to share our burdens and our mistakes with you and that be okay. Because you can share it with us too. And like we'll come alongside each other and help each other out. But it's a very lonely place to be when you feel like you cannot be your authentic, genuine self. And so we have really tried to live that way. So we will tell you kind of our warts and mistakes appropriately. But our life has not been perfect, just like yours hasn't been perfect. So just one last thought. If you don't know much about your pastor's wife, really check in, somebody, even if you don't feel comfortable doing it. Because sometimes, like my mother-in-law, they're being abused. And my mother-in-law was being abused, and that's where her advice was coming from a place of fear and insecurity. And she felt like nobody would believe her if she told. I just encourage you, if your pastor's wife looks sad, go up and pray. Check in, ask. It's so important because they do feel like they can't tell. Now, I'm fine. I just want you to know. But this is also part of the story, right? Because we've been doing this for a long time and we've seen it. And people don't believe it. So on that note, the man of mystery comes up.
Just take it with you, maybe. Just take it with you. No, because I need that space. No. So, my wife Lynn and I are like totally different people. I am planned and have notes and organized, and literally on our way down, Lynn said to me, I have no idea what I'm about to say. I'm like, So Lynn's terrific. Lynn, actually, I'll tell you, I will brag on her. She has two master's degrees, a degree in educational psychology and an MBA in educational leadership. And she's an educational professional and gifted in a lot of ways. And the reason why I'm also sharing that is not just to brag, but also to say, like, we're here this week not just to speak, which is fine, but we're here for you as well. We have one child who's a 24. I'm 6'3". Our son is 6'8". So that's how we hug now. And he's 24 and he doesn't come with us. He works and all sorts of things. And so we're here to be however that you'd want. Some people would love to connect and some people want nothing to do with talking to a pastor this week, and that's fine. But we're here for you. So real quickly, I never wanted to be a pastor. My father was a pastor. He was an average pastor, but an abusive father. So growing up in that environment, like seeing, you know, how people were on Sundays, but real life, Monday through Saturday, left a huge influence on my life. I did go to a Christian college, and I was a history political science major, and I did get C's and D's in my Bible classes, so I'm just being honest with you. This is going to be C level today, so no, just kidding. I did go to seminary and graduate with honors, but when I was younger, I did meet someone who was an analyst for the CIA, and he got me connected with the Student Services Division of the CIA. So that was my goal. I was history, political science. My senior year of college, God changed my life, and I felt like I had nothing to do, but I could only be a pastor. So I've been a pastor now for 24 years, four different churches in one church. So the first time I came on staff in 2000, we were a church of 125, a year and a half old. I was the first assistant hired. 4 years later, our founding pastor left. We were down to 50 people, so I was then pastoring a church. In a sense, it's the same church, but a second church, right? Just 50 total people. 2012, some 8 years later, we had grown to around 200 people, and we were renting all this time, and so all of a sudden now I have two different staff, and so in a sense, it's my third church, even though it's the same church. And then because we have grown and now we're over 1,000 or so, it's somewhat like my fourth church. Like I've had to learn and adapt every single time, even though I've been at one place for 24 years. I do love being a pastor, but I will say, like, it is a very strange calling. And here's why it's strange. Because if we do this right as a pastor, then you should not remember our names. Because we're always pointing people not to us, but to Christ. If we do it right, then there's going to be other people who are better equipped or have more gifts than us. Because the role of the pastor is not to preach or teach or to lead necessarily. That's part of it. But it's also to equip. It's to build other people. It's finding other people with those skills and developing them. If we do this right, then we have the privilege of being with you at every important part of your life journey, which is a wonderful gift that I think is just true. The best definition that I've come across as a pastor, which really has helped to guide me in my life, is that a pastor is a sinner chosen by a group of sinners to help point us all to Jesus. And like, that's it. There's nothing more to it than that. I will say this, and this is what I'm going to share, and then we'll jump in. Most pastors I know are terribly insecure, massively insecure, and we hide it through humor, we hide it through intelligence, we hide it through our gifting or our charisma, but underneath that is massive insecurity, and here's why. We're just laying all the dirt out today, right? If you decide to come to my church, it's more than likely because you like me. You like my style, or you connect with the way that I preach or teach or lead. It's very rare that someone goes to a church and they absolutely love the church and hate their pastor, right? And likely, if you are to leave a church, more often than not, it's because of some conflict with that pastor, their style, their leadership, and how they speak. That's generally true. There are exceptions, but that's generally how it is. And as a pastor, like, we know this. And that idea that people like us or don't like us subtly feeds into our ego, it feeds our pride, and it feeds our sense of self-worth. And what it does is it creates an unhealthy addiction, because we love knowing that we are loved. And this is why so many pastors feel like they're above the law or that they're special or they're needed by God. They want the praise of their people. And we, in turn, easily venerate and worship our pastors, although we would never say that. And what happens then is that pastors get addicted to that worship. The reality is, being a pastor can be an ego drug. We are people pleasers. And this is good, but it's also unhealthy at the same time. Because anytime you want everyone to love you, then it causes destructiveness. This is why, like, did the sun just come out? Oh, my word, look at that. This is why, like, every single year we see pastors failing all the time. Like, it doesn't, every single day we see somebody in the news like this. So I'm just sharing that. Every day we're going to talk a little bit about being a pastor or pastor's spouse to some degree. And then we'll process our content as well. So let's talk a little bit about what we're going to be doing this week. I'm going to talk about sandcastles this morning. As a child, I grew up in Washington State. We would go to Vancouver Island in British Columbia, Miracle Beach, and the tide would go out like hundreds of yards, and then you can build these sand castles, and the tide would come rushing in, and I have like very fond memories of that as a child. A couple years ago, my wife and I were in Ocean City, Maryland, and if you've ever seen professional sandcastle building, like it's incredible. Three-dimensional designs, and I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And the reason why I like this concept of sandcastles, even though we might have experienced it or not, is that I think it's a wonderful analogy for our lives, because I feel like this is where so many of us are at with our lives, that we're building our lives, and really what we're building are sandcastles. Like, we've worked hard to construct our lives, our families, our jobs, our careers, our bank account, our health, our churches, and like in a moment, so many of them just crumble because of the waves that are crashing in. We've talked about COVID-19, we've been there, we've gone through that, we've talked about political tension in our country and the racial tension and all things like that. And we respond to these waves that come crashing in very predictable sorts of ways, like magical thinking, hey, just take this pill or just do that or just do this and that'll fix everything. Or we love to blame shift. Oh, it's those people that are doing this. And if only those people were not here, then our world would be a better place. I mean, this is how we respond when the waves crash against our sandcastles. And it doesn't matter where we're at politically or socially or where we're at spiritually, whether we're brand new with Jesus or far from the Lord or been there, we've all felt like our sandcastles are crashing over us. I had the chance to be with a cohort of pastors from worked with Marquette University, and we spent some time just recently processing these last 3 or 4 years together. And like every single pastor was still in this concept of like hurting because of the way the waves have been crashing over them and their ministry. And I think if we're honest, we could probably all affirm that those waves are crashing in our lives as well. That those things that we have built, that those times that we have put together, that those ideas of what we have worked hard to build feel like they are crashing around us now. I hear people say things like, I wish we can go back to how things were. When can we return to normal? And the problem with that, although it makes sense, the problem with that is, like, what if we never were in control back then anyways? What if what we have lost is the illusion that we ever were in control in the first place? So let's be real. Like, our daily lives consist of this idea that we think we're in control. Like, I know my wife and we have a son and I know my church. I feel like my world is all squared away. We're okay with our staff and our neighbors and all the bills are paid. But the reality is, I'm not sure of how many of us feel like we are actually in control of our lives. I talk with parents all the time. Like, we raise our kids and we did the right thing and we gave them the right environment and they still decide to step out and do self-destructive things. Like, we worked hard at our job and like we poured everything into that job and all of a sudden somebody comes along that's younger or cheaper and replaces us on the job. We have health concerns that come out of nowhere. Our church changes or another church shows up and accidents happen. I mean, all of these things, our relationships crumble. Like, the reality is the sandcastles that we have built, like, the waves are coming all the time and are crashing down over them over and over and over again. And so how do we respond? How do we act? I mean, sometimes it can almost feel hopeless that we're talking about something like this. And the idea is we want something victorious. We want something triumphant. And I wish I could give us something victorious and triumphant. But I'm not going to, not today. Here's what I am going to tell us, is that God has given us a way to embrace these waves. God has given us a method to handle when the waves are crashing all around us, to absorb and adapt when the sandcastles that we have built, whatever they are crumbling around us. And what the Bible calls lament is what we are going to lean into and embrace this morning. And you might be saying to yourself, hey, Jonathan, like right now my sandcastle is going well. Like, this is for somebody else, and that's okay too. Maybe this message then is not for you, but maybe it's for someone that God's going to put in your life soon enough. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I will say for the rest of us, we are probably in this mess right now and need to hear how the Bible helps us deal with lament. So let's go ahead and open our Bibles or turn on our Bibles, whatever is appropriate for you, to the book of Psalms chapter 77, right in the middle of our Bible. the center of our Bibles, the book of Psalms. And we're going to be at chapter 77 this morning. The book of Psalms are songs. So when we think about songs we hear on the radio, right? Sometimes a song is very simple. I was driving the other day and that old Don't Worry, Be Happy song came on, Bobby McFerrin, like very simple, not a lot of depth to it, right? But like it's just a happy song and there's nothing wrong with that. I was prepping a sermon the other day and Public Enemies Fight the Power came on and I was like, oh my word, that's a totally different type of song. Right? I mean, it's literally fighting the system and the man is against us. And there's nothing wrong with like all of those songs. There's a range of emotions when it comes to music. And that's how it is with the Psalms that are in our Bible. There's 150 of them, various authors, wide range of years. Some of the songs are praise. Some of them are celebration. Some of them, though, are anger. Some of those songs are frustration. Some of those songs are blasting God, like literally blasting God. And one of those ancient songs is called lament. It's a style of a song. It's darkness, it's anger, it's frustration. It's when the waves are crashing over us. It's after the fire has gone through and we don't know how to respond. Jesus himself used the psalm of lament, Psalm 22, when Jesus is hanging on the cross and when he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's not some random quote. He's quoting Psalm 22. It's a much longer song of lament. So hang on to that fact that Jesus himself embraced these dark and difficult songs. I will say this, generally speaking, we tend to avoid these types of parts of our Bible. Generally speaking, we don't talk about these types of little bit darker topics because what sells in church, what sells in American church is like hope and victory and believe and just fight through and work harder and trust that God will give us the victory. And like that is true, but sometimes all that is just build your sandcastle a little higher is all that that is. It's also not reality. And I'd rather we embrace the full spectrum of life than live in a bubble of superficial faith. I'd rather we like have a real relationship with Jesus than a cheesy spirituality that's afraid to deal with the pain and the hardships and the struggle. Psalm 77 is a song of lament. The author is a man by the name of Asaph. He's a priest of King David. It's about 1,000 years before the time of Jesus. Can I have a volunteer that would be willing to stand and read out loud the first 9 verses, Psalm 77, verses 1 through 9? We also are very interactive here. So yes, in the back, loud for us all, please. 1 through 9. Excellent, thank you. So notice that this author like is in pain. This author is crying out to God. He is not staying silent. Oh, just a quick note. I did mention I went to seminary, right? Did you know verse 3? Do you see the word Selah there? Does your Bible have that, verse 3? Ancient Hebrew word, it means more cowbell is what that means. Just more cowbell. Okay. I'm not sure what the situation is. And that's what's fascinating for me with Psalm 77 is that we don't know what the thing is that's driving this author to lament. And I love the fact that it's wide open because what it does, it allows us to identify with the pain that is found in there. Oh, this is what it's like being a single parent sometimes. This is what it's like when we're wrestling with addiction. This is what it's like when we have that health crisis or we're afraid of what the other side politically is going to do to our country. Or this is what it's like with the worries that I have about my health or the fear of our children making bad decisions. Like we can read our situation in here. Another translation has this. Look at verse 1. You look at verse 1, and I'm going to read this other translation of the first 3 verses. It says, I yell out to my God. I yell with all my might. I yell at the top of my lungs, and he listens. Verse 2. I found myself in trouble and went looking for my Lord. My life was an open wound that wouldn't heal. When friends said, hey, everything's going to turn out all right, I didn't believe a word they said. Verse 3. I remember God, and I just shake my head. I bow my head, and then I wring my hands. I'm awake at night, not a wink of sleep. I can't even say what's bothering me. I love that other translation of this psalm. Like, this is what it means to lament. It means to be honest before God, to be honest with our struggles. I'm a simple person, and I've got simple thoughts for us, and I've got two thoughts, and here's the first one, and if you want to write this down or take notes, I would encourage you, and here's the first one. Name what is breaking us. When we are wrestling with lament, when we want to go before the Lord, when we want to tell him what is going on, I think it's very important that we actually name and speak what it is that is breaking us. Is it a major wave that is crashing in? Is it a minor wave? Can we name specifically to God what is breaking us? Maybe it's a fear of uncertainty, a loss of control. We don't want to die yet or die alone, or our children will abandon us, or that loneliness is like coming in. And the way I think about it is kind of like this. Like when I'm counseling with someone, if we're not able to identify what the problem is, then it's very hard to find a solution to that problem. If we are unwilling to speak, it can make it difficult to heal. And this gives ourselves the freedom to honestly name our hurts out loud. You know, for some of us, like our hurts, like they're so deep that we're not even talking with God. And that makes sense, and that is okay. Like I've been there and you've been there, and that's normal, but just because it's normal doesn't necessarily make it the best. And the challenge for us is to name what is breaking us. That opens the dialogue with God. That we include that in our prayers, and it allows us to be direct and open with God and allows for that healing to start. And so the challenge that I want to give us today, and not just for right now, but sometime during the week, is that can you name that wave that is crashing in over you? And just allow yourself to think about that. Look again at verse 7. Will the Lord reject me forever? Will he never show his favor again? Has his unfailing love vanished forever? Has his promise failed for all time? Has God forgotten to be merciful? Has he in anger withheld his compassion? I mean, the author is saying, like, God, why aren't you acting? Why aren't you doing anything? Why aren't you fixing this? Like, I love the honesty that's found in Psalm 77. God, you're supposed to be victorious. I've heard all these stories about your mighty hand and all these people sing about you. Then deliver, like show up for me. Why are these waves crashing in over everything that I am building? I think it's just so much better for us to ask these questions than not. I think it's so much better for us to speak this way than to hold it in. You know, as a parent, like I want our son to talk to us, even though if I don't like it, like I want to hear what is going on. Lament gives us permission to be honest and real with God. And that's a beautiful gift for every single one of us. How about a volunteer that we're willing to read the balance of the chapter, verses 10 through 20? I need you to stand and out loud. Yes, thank you. So a shift occurs here in verse 11, and we have the key word remember, which is there twice in that verse. And what the author does is does something very powerful for us. The author begins to look backwards at the past actions of God for help, looking backwards for confidence and assurance. Notice verse 12, I'm going to meditate on your works, on your mighty deeds. All of a sudden, verse 14, he talks about the God of miracles. Verse 15, he actually names Jacob and Joseph. That's like 1,000 years before the author is alive here. And then all of a sudden, the author goes back in verse 16 to talking about God rescuing the people out of Egypt. All of this about the waters, that's all like allusion to the Red Sea splitting. And so the author then is starting to think about this story that occurs 1,000 years earlier with the Exodus, when God is rescuing the people and God is moving in a very powerful way in the 10 plagues and what God did with Moses and Aaron leading them out of Egypt, right? What this song is doing is going back to like the highest moment of this history of this nation, when God went head to head with the greatest superpower around, Egypt, and how God leveled the nation of Egypt. And that brings us to a second truth. And the second truth is this, and you can write this down. Looking backwards gives us confidence in moving forward with Jesus. Looking backward gives us confidence in moving forward with Jesus. I do not say that lightly. That is not some cheesy, superficial, fluffy faith. I just have no time for that. Here's what that means, is that look back at all the ways that God has shown himself faithful in our life. And when we go backwards and reflect upon all the ways that God has been there time and time again, that gives us confidence than moving forward in our lives. Like if we had time right now to talk, like what I have in my notes is like, spend 5 minutes with those around you and start talking about how has God shown himself faithful in your life? Can you list that? Can you come up with five different ways? And not just five, then can you come up with like another five ways that God has shown himself faithful to you? And here's what that does for you. It reframes for us, not our pain, but it reframes our view of God. Remembering God's faithfulness may not change my present circumstances right now, but it changes my view of who is actually in control, of who I'm talking to, of who I can trust, of who my God really is. The author here of Psalm 77 goes back 1,000 years to think about how God rescued the people out of Egypt. And he uses that as a reference point. That God that went against the greatest nation in the world is the same God who loves me and cares for me and is active and with me right now today. The reality is the list is a mile long of the types of waves that are crashing in on every single one of us. We don't have time to talk about them, but the reality is like they are crashing against our sandcastles that we built. And some people want to go backwards to the good old days. Go back to like how things were because we thought we were in control. And I'm just going to make it clear, going backwards is never good. The only people that want to go backwards are the people that have always held power. That's not what God is looking for. Our sandcastles are crumbling all around us. And they remind us that we were never really in control. And God's word gives us a beautiful way to handle this. And it's called lament, Psalm 77. It's a song of pain. It's a song of grief. Lament pauses us in our pain. It causes us to stop, to grieve, to embrace our emotions and take them to God. And maybe what we need to do is actually practice lament. Like, can we name and identify what sandcastles are crashing down around us right now in our life? And that's something I will encourage you to do. And then the second thing I want us to do is, can we start practicing looking backwards so that we can have confidence moving forward in our relationship with Jesus? Can we list like five ways that God has come through in our life? And after we list those five, can we come up with another five? And another five. Can we fill up a page of the way that God has been faithful to us? This might sound cheesy. It might sound fluff. It might sound like we're engaging our emotions and we're not supposed to do that. And I'm just going to remind us that like this is what Jesus did on the cross when he cried out the Psalm of Lament, Psalm 22. This is Jesus who's weeping at the tomb of his friend Lazarus. This is Jesus praying in the middle of severe emotional pain, fully in touch with his emotions. When our sandcastles are being knocked over, or the theme of Fort this summer is when the fire sweeps through our lives, this is an opportunity for us to lament, to go before the God in our brokenness, to name what is causing us heartache, and then all of a sudden to practice looking backwards that will give us confidence moving forward. That's what I have for us this morning. Let me pray. And then we will dismiss us to whatever is next. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this. Thank you for an opportunity to sing together. Like, that's such a beautiful gift. Thank you for the power of looking in your word. I'm so thankful, Lord, that words that are 3,000 years old, like they are describing us right now. Like we can read our story into Psalm 77. Lord, I'm so thankful that you've given us a way to handle our emotions, that you've given us an outlet for the grief and for the sandcastles that are crumbling around us. May all of this, Lord, cause us to draw closer and closer to your Son, a man who is acquainted with grief. And it's in your Son, our Savior's name, we pray. Amen. I want to turn it over to Craig here for final announcements for us.